You're listening to The Aaron Carrera Show. And now your host, Aaron Carrera.
Hey, everybody. It is Aaron Carrera, your host. And I am pre-recording this episode, which is meant for Thursday, March 7th, on Sunday, March 3rd. So you may hear a soccer match in the background and or people shouting, i.e. by people, I mean my husband, shouting, goal! And so if that happens, look, friends, I'm pre-recording this show, and the reason I'm doing it, even though there's noise in the background, is because I have a busy few weeks, and I wanted to make sure I got an episode out for everybody and continued the series we've been talking about. So before I get into what we've been talking about, which is using acting tools to make your life run better, or to have more life, or just to enjoy life more, I'm going to explain a little bit about what I've been up to and why I'm pre-recording this. So a lot of you know that my husband and I are, in addition to me being a psychic, I also am a writer and a performer. And my husband and I wrote a screenplay, and we've written many, but this one was sold to an independent director-producer who got the movie funded. And the movie starts filming this week. Also, when the movie is sold, there's often many changes people want you to make at many intervals. So at first, when he optioned the project, which means he gave us a little bit of money and we came up with a contract, and he has the option to buy the project within a certain amount of time, he asked for a few small changes, which we did. Then he got his full funding, and the producer who came on board also had some ideas and wanted to do some changes. So we went through another round of rewrites. It's all totally normal. A film is a collaborative effort. Then a star came on board to play the lead role, and she had some ideas. So then we all went through, and it becomes more and more collaborative every time, right? Now this last round of writing was collaborative between me and my husband as the writers, the producer, the director, and the star. So now five people are involved. Now, if this were a studio movie, there would be many, many, many more notes. There would be studio executives getting their hands in on things, depending on who the stars were and how many stars there were and who was the most important star. You know, they'd have ideas. It's just the process. Anyhow, so that takes a lot of time. And we are going to be on set during filming, even though we're not actually producing. We're going to be on set for a variety of reasons and participating in filmmaking. And so I'm going to be away from 1-2 Radio. Now, I'm not going to be gone from 1-2 Listen, just my hours will be shortened. And so, at the same time, my parents are visiting for a month. The timing just worked out that way. So I want to make sure that I have time for everything. 1-2 Listen, my family, the film, sleep. And maybe sometimes, I don't know, eating and exercising. And 1-2 Radio. So I'm pre-recording this show, and so I hope you'll forgive noise in the background, but I wanted to be sure that I got an episode ready for this week, and now was a good time to do it. All right, so if you like what you're listening to in general, and you want to work with me, come find me. I'm Aaron at 1-2-Listen. That's 1-2-Listen.com/Aaron. And if you don't see me online because I'm out and about with my parents or in a meeting, please know I am so happy to talk with you. And if you simply make a callback request or schedule an appointment or reach out, I will get back to you as soon as I can within a few hours, and we'll find a time that works for both of us. Alternatively, if you order an email-based service, that means a written channeled message or a pre-recorded, or not pre-recorded, but I'll record for you and send it to you, channeled message, or various other items I have up there, like tarot card readings, EFT tapping sessions, that I can do when I have some time set aside, and I can create that for you. And I love my email-based sessions. So please go take a look at those as well. All right. Now, we have been discussing taking acting tools and applying them to our life. And I'll explain again why. Like I did at the beginning of the series, because first of all, there have been so many good movies lately. Like the 2023 contenders for the Oscars and the SAG-AFTRA awards, there were such good movies. I know some of my choices are controversial, but I loved I loved Poor Things. I loved American Fiction. I loved Anatomy of a Fall. So many great movies. And that's in addition to Barbie and Oppenheimer and so many other wonderful films. I actually still have one left to see. Oh my goodness, there's one left. And it's one I've wanted to see for so long. But anyway, there, in particular, Anatomy of a Fall. The acting is so incredible in that movie. Just so amazing. And I was thinking of all of the ways that actors use different tools to create compelling real-life characters in difficult situations, fighting and striving their way through things. And then I was thinking about how you can use those tools to reverse engineer your life. You know, actors use the tools to create a, pardon my language, fucked up person. Well, we're all kind of fucked up, honestly. We really are. Anybody who thinks that they are not worries me. It means that they are not self-reflective. Unless, okay, it's different if you've done a ton of work on yourself or something. Like, I think that if I'm honest, I'm like, no, I'm not saying I'm fucked up. Like, oh my God, I'm so fucked up. There's no hope for me. I just mean like, oh no, there's definitely flaws and things that are not attractive about me and all that kind of thing. Well, we can use these acting tools to defuck ourselves, right? So we talked first about being in the body, because the most important thing as an actor is to be in your body. And that is surprisingly difficult for a lot of people, especially in modern times. Then we talked about environment, and then we talked about listening. We spent 2 days on listening, and there's still so much more to say. But the next tool that I would like to talk about is called the moment before. So in acting, a moment before is right before a scene starts. So if you think about a scene, I'm trying to think of a famous scene like When Harry Met Sally, and well, that's not a good example. It is. They're all good examples. Any movie with good acting, any TV show with good acting, there's an actor's always going to have a moment before. So if you think about, for example, I'm trying to think of a recent movie I just saw. Okay, brilliant. If you all please go watch Anatomy of a Fall. It is a German-French co-production. It's in German, French, and English with subtitles. It's got Sandra Hüller as the star, but it's an amazing film, amazing drama. It's a drama. And there's a scene in the beginning where she is an author. Sandra Hüller's character is an author, and she has a young student who's also over to interview her. I think interviewing her, she's a professor and a teacher of writing, and she's also an author. And I actually cannot recall exactly if the student is also interviewing her for a student journalism project. I hate to admit that I need to watch it again, because I was just so drawn into Sandra Hüller's amazingness. Anyway, so there's a scene, and the two of them are having this conversation. And then later in the movie, we get to see the moment before that conversation. And it's very interesting. It's a very interesting moment before. So now, a moment before, let's say you are doing an acting scene, is before the action starts in a scene. Before, like if you've ever done a play in high school, you read a play or you've seen a movie, before a scene starts, it's whatever was going on right before that scene starts. And it wasn't boring. It wasn't interesting. Everybody's always coming from somewhere. It means that for an actor, the goal is to create a moment before that puts you in a state of mind to immediately create obstacle with the person you're in the scene with, and to immediately create a driving, a need, a motivation, a thing you've got to get out of your scene partner, a thing you've got to get out of the scene. But it's also got to be motivated by the moment before. And that doesn't mean the moment before is like the mafioso said, you better get this money or I'll kill your kid, although that could be it. It's more like the moment before is something that adds so much pressure, like loads the gun. Like if you have an unopened can of Coke, shakes up that can of Coke, and the scene is where you're going to open that can and it's all going to spray out. So that's the goal as an actor, is to use this moment before to create something really messed up, right? Really intense, really deeply needed, something very motivated. But as a person, how can we use this moment before in our real lives? We actually can use it by being very conscious of our own personal moments before, first of all. There's a couple ways. But first of all, whenever you are going somewhere, you might be hearing my husband in the background with his soccer team. They got a goal. So let's say yay for Napoli. Anyway, okay, moment before, right? Like my moment before, right before Carlo yelled goal and started cheering, right? My moment before is I was just channeling information for a radio show at a slightly odd time, which is my window of opportunity to record in the apartment I have with bad walls. Normally my husband's not around, right? This time of day, but here we are. And it's totally cool. And it's no problem. It just means real life is happening all around us. So I was in the middle of channeling about the moment before and how you can use it to become aware of your own moments before when this radio show was interrupted by his jubilance. Now, if I were the kind of person who, well, I am a perfectionist, but I let it go. Life circumstances have forced me to let that go. So if I were in an acting scene, that would be the eruption to a fight, right? But instead, it's like, oh, look, I'm so happy his team scored. Oh, I hope it's at least tied. I really do. Anyhow, because they're my team too. Okay, so in a moment before, your own personal moments before, we're never coming from nowhere. Even the moment we're born, we're coming from the moments our mother's womb. So you're never coming from nowhere. So you burst into the kitchen and you're in one mood, and everybody in the kitchen is in a different mood. It's like, what do you do? Who do you defer to? What are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to behave, right? If you remember, they too have a moment before. You're becoming aware of your moment before. One thing I've started doing is anytime I go anywhere, meet anybody, I try to take a moment and I take a stock of, okay, where am I at? Put my hands on my heart. Where am I at? Now I'm going into a meeting with this person, or I'm going to see my parents, or I'm going to receive this one-to-listen phone call. Where am I coming from, and can I take stock of where I'm at, and what is my intention for what's about to happen, and can I let go of the moment before or use that moment before in a positive way to enhance what I'm about to do? This is how we can use a moment before very consciously. So for example, let's say I was recording this show and somebody called me on one to listen. I could be using all of this beautiful information that's channeling through me, and I get the phone call and I put my hand on my heart and I pray for a moment to be of service to my caller and to be of deep assistance to them in whatever they may need. And I'm setting an intention that my moment right before I click and say hello is one of gratitude and service and care. Let's say you need to go have a discussion with somebody that might become confrontational. Rather than be all worried and freaked out all week about it, and then leading up to it, you are not even dealing with your own feelings, and you're just a ball of stress, and you're yelling at the kids, and you're yelling at your husband, but you gotta go talk to your boss, in this example. And you show up at work, and you open up in, and you're so stressed out, you don't even remember to give the pleasantries, and you sit down, and you've just set up a scenario for more stress and potential conflict. Instead, you could say, all right, I know I'm going to have this conversation. I'm going to spend a little bit of time acknowledging my stress throughout the week and my fear. I'm not going to deny that fear, but I'm not going to let it run me either. I'm going to use that fear and say, all right, thank you for the information. Thank you for letting me know. I'm afraid of this conversation. And I'm going to do a little research on how to converse with people, how to talk with people, what I want to do, how to respond in certain situations. What are some power poses? What are some colors I could wear that are in alignment with my attention? And the morning of, I'm going to make sure that I get a good night's sleep before I get a good breakfast. And I'm going to go in to the conversation. And right before I open the door, right before I even leave my car, I'm going to set an intention that this conversation is great. It goes my way, but in a way that's my way plus mutually beneficial for both of us, right? You're being conscious of your moment before in a way that can really serve you and assist you. And you're calling upon the universe to help guide you in that way. Now, the other way that you can use a moment before is to understand that everybody else in the world also has their moments before. And I know you're saying, Erin, why do I have to be the only person who's consciously aware of my moment before? Well, you're not. And you don't have to be. But, I don't know, how easy it is for you to control other people. But since we can only do the work on ourselves, some of the work on ourselves can be understanding that people are coming from wherever they're coming from. So that if I'm sitting here doing this 1-2 radio show, I'm pre-recording, and all of a sudden, if my sweet dear Carlo were to burst in and say, "Oh my God, we won, and I'm in the middle of channeling information, his moment before is one of total joy. And it would be easy for a lot of us to just get really annoyed. Like, can't you see I'm working here? But no, he just wants to share his happiness and his joy. I mean, it would be unusual for him to just burst in without checking to see if I'm on the phone with somebody first. But, you know, it would be coming from a place of love and joy and happiness and wanting to share all of that with me because he loves me, right? So if I remember that moment before, like, oh, I don't know. I did a really bad boo-boo in traffic the other day. I was trying to cross and the light was turning red and two cars went left right in front of me. So then I was in the middle of the intersection and people just started going and I had to honk and honk and honk and everybody was honking at me and so angry. And they were right to be because I was in the middle of the intersection after the light had turned red. Now, I could have gotten mad at those people who had got turned left when it was my turn to go. But why, like, get mad at them? Well, they've already driven off and they're not even paying attention. I mean, it's too bad that people drive crazy, but I should have maybe just stayed one foot nose out and let people go around me rather than go all the way through, right? Really not the greatest idea, but there really wasn't a way to win. So I wasn't mad at anybody for honking back at all. I was just like, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. Bless you. And I made it through and everyone was safe and all was well. And it was probably very nerve-wracking for a couple of people in there for just a second. But how could I possibly get mad at people for being mad at me, for me being the one in the wrong place? I didn't have the right of way anymore. And they weren't paying attention to the fact that these people, they were on the far right-hand side of the street of like a four-lane on all sides. So like they didn't know that I had to deal with these, you know, people turning left when it was really my right of way. They just wanted to get through. So the whole thing becomes like a domino effect, right? Now, probably me not getting mad at anybody for their moment before is not going to create world peace. But it did make me very grateful. And I was a little more cautious for the rest of my drive because I just thought, okay, you know, you are on your way somewhere important. Be careful, be safe. So, you know, that's a silly example. But if we go back to the example of you're going into a meeting with your boss and you have to have a meeting, perhaps a little confrontational, can you understand where they're coming from? Can you understand not just their moment before, but their whole life before? Not because they're right and you're wrong. This is not to subject you. This is not to make you prostrate to them, but to help you understand where they're coming from. First of all, because if you know where they're coming from, if you can hear where their listening is, then you can better speak to their listening and better plead your case because you're speaking to their listening, right? It's like if you want your boss to give you a raise, you need more than just to feel like you deserve one. You need to see where they're coming from and then offer them evidence, right? Because they're coming from, I'm getting pressure from the higher-ups, I'm getting pressure on this front. And they might be jerks, okay? They might be assholes and terrible people, but it doesn't mean that they're not still having their own moments before and their own way of listening. So if you can tune into that and present to them in a way they can understand, you just do a lot of the work for them. And guess what? If you do a lot of their work for them in a way that benefits you, I mean, you know, that's a great way to get things done, right? So you do the work of explaining and coming up with evidence about why you deserve that raise and that promotion, and you've done a lot of the work for them so they can see it clearly. You're more likely to achieve your result, to get what you want, right? Okay. So then the next tool in our acting tools is the overall driving force. Now, this was a tool that was given to me by a teacher named Candace Silver. She got it from a guy named Cameron Thorne, I think. In acting, in drama, in theater, in films, in movies, all scenes can be boiled down to one overall driving force. Well, one of three: love, power, or death. And we could even say it all ultimately boils down to love. But for the purpose of this tool, it's either love, power, or death. Now, how do you know if something is, okay, if we're talking acting, how do you know if something is in acting is a death scene? Well, let me tell you. The only reason something in acting is a death scene is because somebody dies in the scene. So, spoiler alert, Shakespeare's play, The Tragedy of Hamlet, spoiler alert, spoiler alert, spoiler alert, at the end, spoiler alert, Hamlet dies, okay? Now, the whole play is not a death scene, although the play does very much deal with the theme of death. His father dies, and he sees his father's ghost, and he learns some unsavory information about his mother and his uncle, and there's a lot of other things going on in this play, but ultimately a lot of it is dealing with one's own, who am I after the loss of a parent, and who am I when my whole worldview gets shaken up and what I thought was reality isn't reality, and who can I believe and who can I trust and who can't I trust? But the death scenes are only when people die, okay? So the onstage deaths are, spoiler alert, Polonius, who's the advisor and the father of his girlfriend, and Hamlet. Ophelia dies, but she dies off stage. And then it's reported later by Gertrude, his mother. Other people die, but I'm just saying, like, the only scene for Hamlet that is a death scene where he, well, there's two, because he, spoiler alert, kills Polonius. So that's a death scene when Polonius dies, and it's a death scene when Hamlet dies. It is not a death scene when he hears about Ophelia's death after the fact, because it is too late to make it different. But when something is a death scene, it is about doing everything in your power to make it different than it is, right? Even when Hamlet kills Polonius, he's trying to make the world and the life that he's living different than it is. He cannot deal with the reality of what's happening with his mother and his uncle. He cannot deal with the reality of what's happening with his girlfriend, and his girlfriend's dad, Polonius, is just this fool. He cannot deal, right? So he's trying to make it different. Oops. When Hamlet dies and his friend Horatio comes to him, Horatio is trying to make it different than it is. He's trying to make it different. He's trying to find a way. When he says, "And sleeps my sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy death," right? He's trying to say, find a way to still connect to this man he loves. So there's so much to be said for acting, but that's a death scene. Okay. Love or power? In essence, in acting, scenes can boil down to, this is a love scene or a power scene. Now, how do you know? You know because it's what you're trying to get. By the way, and it can be different for different characters, right? So it's what you're trying to get from the other person. So, for example, in the scene between you and the boss, it might be a power scene for you, but a love scene for your boss. Your boss already has power over you. They don't need it. What they need is you to behave. And how are they going to get you to do what they want you to do? By earning your trust, your respect, in essence, love. Although we don't say it because we're these sanitized, clinicized, corporatized people in modern life. But, right? So you don't have power over your boss. So you're trying to get power. Now, you may try to get power through love, right? Starts to get sticky, right? But basically, you'll know what is going on in your scene by what you're trying to get out of a person. Now, you might be saying, Erin, I'm not trying to get anything out of my husband, which I'll say, bullshit. Like, no way, right? We are trying to get them to agree to go out to dinner with their parents to the restaurant they don't like. We're trying to get them to agree that, yes, the trash should be taken out more regularly. We're trying to get them to agree that we need to be spending money this way. We're trying to get them to agree that they should pick up their clothes. They're trying to get us to agree that we should relax. I'm just speaking about my own life. They're trying to get us to agree that that one friend is not worth the time or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Like, they love us. We love them. So it's a power scene a lot in a marriage. And sometimes you might have lost your love for your spouse, and so you're trying to find your love again. You might feel that your spouse isn't loving you, so you're trying to get their love. Sometimes when people get really needy, it's actually trying to get love when they already have it, and so it comes off as a weird, unattractive, passive-aggressive, upside-down power play. Isn't that interesting? So you start to see, like, oh, when I'm needy, that's actually a power move. Oh, because I don't feel like I'm getting enough from them, or I don't feel like I deserve it, so I am constantly testing, so I need to have power over them because I'm afraid of losing, and that's why I'm being needy. Interesting, right? Ultimately, of course, everything is all ideally, but actually, I believe, truly, always about love. Or one could say always about death in a way, because death is such a huge, important part of life. Perhaps a conversation for another time. Perhaps not. We'll see what I channel as we continue to talk about the overall driving force of a scene. But when we're talking about how to use this now to better our lives, is that it's another way of looking at where someone else is coming from, but it's understanding your own motivations as well. So that if you're like, okay, my motivation is I really, really want my kids to clean up their rooms. I already have power over them because I'm the parent. And I love them. What are you talking about, Erin? I love them. Yeah, but you're about to pull a power play. So the kids are going to argue, and they're going to, you might even think your kids have power over you, although God help you, I hope you don't. I hope that's not true. But in today's day and age, who knows? And I'm not saying that there aren't great kids or that children should not be seen or heard or any of that kind of crap. I just feel like sometimes people give kids way too much power before they're ready. But if you want the kids to clean their room, they're going to try to convince you not to by being cute, by being whiny, right? They're going to use all these different ways. I'm already dipping into other tools. They're going to use all these different ways to either get power from you because they don't have the power you do. Whereas you're going to be using all these different ways because the power isn't working to get them to love you, to do it because they love you, because they respect you, which is a aspect of love in a parent-child relationship, right? If you know that they're going to be trying to get power from you, maybe there's a way you can already come in with a game plan in mind. Like, okay, I know you don't want to clean your room, but the reason it's so important to me is because I love you so much and it's unhealthy. That's one way to do it. Or you could say, look, I know you don't really want to clean your room, so I thought I'd offer to do it with you. You know, we could put on some fun music and clean it together. Or you could do what my grandmother used to do. She used to say, okay, let's play a hand of poker. And whoever wins this hand of poker decides who cleans. She won a lot of hands. She was really good at poker. I'm not that good at poker. But she was very fair. She would win, but sometimes she would say, I'll clean. Or she would win and she would say, you clean. Or she would win and say, let's clean together, right? So she wasn't always making us clean, even if she always won the poker game. Almost always. So you see, understanding these kinds of dynamics, right, they can really help you in all of your interactions. Because then we get to the next acting tool, which is stakes. Stakes, okay? What are stakes? Stakes are your character's engagement with what is happening in the scene, right? What are the stakes? Like, what could they lose? What have they got to lose? And what could they win, right? So you want, as an actor, the highest stakes possible, right? So it's a lot about how much this, if they don't get what they want, what that will cost the character. And if they do get what they want, what that will give the character, right? Now, the easy examples, right, are like when you're, if you have a sick child who's very sick and you are rushing to the hospital, your stakes of getting to the hospital as soon as possible are literally potentially life and death, right? Now, the stakes in our scene we're walking in to have a confrontational meeting with the boss. We're asking for a raise. What are your stakes walking in, right? your stakes are, if I don't get this raise, I don't feel respected. I don't get what I want at work. I don't have enough money to take a vacation. I don't have enough money to save up for retirement. It's a way that I can know that I'm valued at work, which is really important to me. It's a way for me to feel motivated to continue to do the work, because otherwise I'm going to be demotivated, right? These are all different stakes we have. My stakes for getting this radio show completed in a timely fashion were so high, I thought, okay, sure, I will go ahead and do a radio show, even though there's a lot of commotion going on all around me. Because my stakes are, if I don't do this radio show, I'm not giving people a show every week because I'm busy. That's unacceptable to me. I want them to know I care. I want people to know that I'm committed to this work and I'm committed to sharing what I have set out to do. Also, my stakes are personal. I keep my commitments. I really work to keep my commitments. And even though I rarely overcommit myself anymore, at the moment I am overcommitted a little bit, but I am dedicated to giving my all, giving my best, doing my absolute best, and providing material for people that is useful and maybe even fun sometimes, right? So the thing is that in acting, you want the stakes as high as possible. But in real life, we act like the stakes aren't happening when they are, and we act like the stakes are super high when they're not, like traffic, right? Like we get so angry, we yell and we turn red in the face. We turn into these evil, angry people when we're driving. In a way, we'd never do that with like other people, at least I hope, right? The goal is to, the other aspect of that is, it is always easier to have something when you don't need it. Have you ever noticed? It's like my mother used to say, nothing begets work like work. Work always begets more work. Yes, it's easier to get a job when you already have a job. It's weird and true. I cannot tell you how much easier it was to meet men once I started dating Carlo years and years ago. And even still, it's like, well, part of this is just a statement about life, but you know, people hit on me and I'm like, well, I'm married. And they're like, they don't care. It's like, no, I'm not interested. I'm married means I'm not interested and I was being nice. But it's like something about being slightly unavailable, not needing to meet somebody, just makes it really easy to meet people. I was out at my friend had a film premiere on Tuesday and I went to the premiere and the after party with her. And the after party was at this little club in Hollywood. And I was just sitting talking at the bar with a few people. And at one point I turned around and I saw this guy looking at me and I turned back to my friends and was chatting. And then I turned around to grab my drink and he was staring at me again. And I was like, I'm not even going to bother, even though he's very handsome. Of course I'm not going to bother. I'm married to a man I love deeply who was also handsome. Not that that's what I care about. But it was like, you know, when I was single, if I had known that, I would have acted like I was married all the time because it's like he just wouldn't stop looking at me. Now, maybe he thought he knew me, but I think that if I had given him any sign, he would have come to talk to me. If I'd caught his eye, you know, one more time, or if I had like looked a third time on purpose, I'm sure he would have come said hello. And it just was because I don't need him. And it's not about like how you look either, because I have other girlfriends, gorgeous girlfriends, who are single, who are looking, who want it, who are having a hard time meeting guys. Now, of course, who knows this guy in a bar, if he's any good or not, you know what I'm saying? So, of course, he's a child of God or whatever crap we want to say, but you know, like suitable for dating for anybody or not. But he did not go hit on my friend who was very beautiful, who was standing right next to me. He did not come say hello to her, and she was single. It's like, okay, maybe he likes blue eyes instead of brown, but I doubt it. I really don't think so. I kind of think it was my energy. I just didn't care, didn't need it. And so it was easier to have. Now, that's speculative, but I'm sure you have many experiences where it's just easier to get it when you don't need it. And maybe when you don't even want it, you know? I have this funny way of saying, they have this funny way of saying things in Hollywood. If you're an actor, if you want an audition, the number one way to make sure you get an audition, book a trip out of town. It's a funny, weird little rule, like as soon as you're occupied, but it makes sense, right? Because it's like, yes, you're working toward this thing, but as soon as you release the tension, you take your attention off it, you kind of release some of those stakes. You're lowering those stakes and it allows the universe to just flood in with all its goodness. It actually makes everything so much more available. So I encourage you to think about an obstacle you're going through in your life or a relationship that's difficult and think about the subject matter and what your stakes are for that relationship and for that subject matter. And is there any way, okay, so think about the obstacle and think about the person or persons involved. And I want you to think about what your stakes are, right? Like my stakes with my kids are that they get 4.2.5 grade point averages so that they get into the great colleges they need to go to make sure that they get a good job after college, to make sure they can live their lives and afford their lives. Because otherwise, I mean, I don't know. I have to get a good parent, or else what are they going to do? They might end up homeless living in a van down by the river, which in this day and age might not always be that bad of a thing. But, you know, if they wanted to do it on purpose, hashtag van life, you know what I'm saying? But I'm just saying, right, like a lot of parents, their stakes for their kids are so high that they actually burn those kids out prematurely. Of course, I am sure college is competitive. It's important to really try to set your kids up for what's going to be best for them in their lives according to who they are and what they want. And I was an overachiever in school. I know. I'm preaching to my own choir here. But are your stakes? Of course, there are times when a parent's stakes must be higher than the child's stakes because that is parenting. But what if you checked yourself and asked yourself, is there any way that lowering these stakes could potentially bring about something good? And what if I even tried it just for a few areas that feel already less important? Like instead of making it about grades, what if it was like about an extracurricular activity? What if I didn't pressure my kids, but instead was inviting or encouraging or inspirational, right? Just as an example. So that if your stakes are to meet a guy, let's say you're going out, you're going out with your married girlfriend, that would be me, and you're going out to meet a guy, your stakes of meeting a guy are so high because you really want to be in a love relationship. You really do. And you're really lonely and you got your girlfriend to come out with you this one time. She's never free. She's always with her stupid husband, or in my case, smart husband, but you know what I'm saying? And your stakes to meet a guy are so high, it almost sends a signal that becomes a turnoff. And then you go out and your girlfriend might be meeting men, and now she's probably pretty cool and she's probably saying, oh, I'm married, but you should meet my friend. She's amazing. Unless the guy is gross, then she would say, sorry, married, right? Or whatever. I mean, I'm using my own life as an example. Please translate it for your own life, but right? Versus it's like if you let yourself go out with a girlfriend, and yeah, maybe the point is to go where there are single guys and meet some people, but you can confab with your girlfriend ahead of time. Like, okay, we're both going to be kind of low stakes about this. This is just for fun, just to see who's out there. Let's play a fun little manifesting game where if there is a, like, let's ask the universe to bring a guy who's suitable, who comes and asks for my number. And you make it, you set that intention, and then your married girlfriend can say, great, and I will have fun living vicariously through you, or whatever. Or great, I look forward to trying the margaritas at this new bar, or whatever that is. I look forward to catching up with you, my beloved friend, and I'm going to make it all about you because I want to hang out with you, whatever that might be, right? Can we lower the stakes? Can we allow our brains to come up with a list of ways to lower stakes in a way that might be helpful, right? So I have some bad habits of making things higher stakes that don't need to be, like getting to dinner with the family 2 minutes early. Like, I hate being late, but is it really necessary if we're meeting at 5 for me to be there at 4:58? Like, if we're there at 5:04, isn't that really fine? You know? So I have to constantly talk myself into relaxing about things when I'm running late. And I've practiced this now for a few years and I'm much better about it. I generally leave with a lot of time because I don't like rushing and I don't like being late. But I leave with a lot of time. And if I'm early, then I just hang out for a minute. And if I'm late, I just talk myself down. I say, it's okay. You'll get there when you get there. The important thing is to get there on time, in one piece, happy, healthy, and safe. Right? Happy, healthy, and safe. Okay. One last tool for this episode, which is that you, the person I'm speaking to, in an acting scene, you are the most important person in my life, or you are the love of my life. If it's a power scene, you are the most important person in my life. If it's a love scene, you are the love of my life. It's also dependent upon a relationship. If I'm talking about my nephew in trouble, you are the love of my life. Without you, right, I will not have this nephew I love deeply. If it's my neighbor, it's like, and I have to talk to them about dealing with the wonderful sweetheart of a drug addicted homeless guy in my garage. It's like, you are the most important person in my life. Now, in an acting scene, what makes compelling acting is to make the other person in the scene, the person you're talking to, the most important scene. Automatically, that makes anybody else in the scene an obstacle to what you're trying to get out of that person. And yes, in acting scenes, sometimes people talk to 3 people or 100 people, but whoever you are talking to is the most important, and then the others become an obstacle. And if you switch who you're talking to, that person becomes the most important, and the others become the obstacle. This might be a little technical acting stuff, but I think you're with me. Well, how does this translate to real life? First of all, when I started learning that tool, I realized so often I would be in a conversation with somebody and I wasn't making them the most important thing in my life. I was making my thoughts or my fantasies, my imagination, what I needed, what I had to do later that day, other people in the room, the most important thing. What they were thinking of me became the most important thing. Or even the thing I'm doing, right? Like if I'm, sorry about the noise. If I'm washing dishes, I mean, I'm not saying I'm perfect at this, but it's about being present, right? It's like making washing the dishes the most important thing in my life at this moment. So actually just gives me a higher quality life. Yeah, I might be listening to a podcast. So we can talk about that stuff. But when it comes to people, relationship, that's so important. Relationship is so important, even if it's somebody that you don't, might never see again. If you just spent a day practicing making each person you speak to the most important person in your life, I think you would be amazed at the quality of the day that you would have, the quality of the interactions, the presence you would have to them, and the presence you would inspire in them, right? If you were to make this conversation you're about to have with your boss, yes, removing the stakes, but making this person, giving them your presence, the gift of your presence, giving them you, giving them all of you, right? Like Alan Watts, I recently saw this Instagram video of Alan Watts talking about the Buddha, whose nickname, means enlightened one, one who is awakened, one who is awakened. He woke up. And what does it mean to be awakened? According to Alan Watts, is to be so fully here as a human person. And most people are not fully here as a human person. If you practice really being present, really making this person in this conversation the most important person in your life, just for this conversation, not forever. I'm not talking about forever. I'm not going to make my neighbor the most important person in my life for, you know, the next 30 years. No, I'm making them the most important person in this moment. And the proof is that's who I'm talking to. This is what's happening. We're here. This is the thing we're doing right now. It's not the phone. I'm not, you know, like my life isn't on Instagram. My life isn't on what happened yesterday. My life isn't on what's going to happen in 3 years or whether or not I'm, you know, going to run out of money or whether or not the climate change is going to become terrible. Although these are things to think about and make important. Right now, this conversation is the most important thing. This is it. This is life. This is what's happening right now. And so what do I do about that? You pay attention. Do you know that paying attention is a kind of prayer? So that when you pay attention to the person you're speaking with, or the person you're with, or the people you're around, or the world you're in, you're actually praying. You're praying.
Now, you don't have to pay attention and swallow what somebody's telling you. Just observe. Just pay attention. All right, friends. So that's all the time I have today. But I wanted to thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Erin Carrera Show. And I'll be back next week with another episode. In the meantime, you can come find me at whentolisten.com/Erin. And like I said, if I'm not there, please do make a callback request or schedule an appointment. And I challenge you just for today, make each person you're speaking to the most important person and just see what happens when you do that. Just as an experiment, just to see. All right, I love you.